My name is Tom B. Haven, and I teach here in the MFA program of fiction. And introducing Gene Thompson this evening is a genuine pleasure. It also feels weird, though, jarring, melancholy, nostalgic, and in Kurt Vonnegut's famous phrase, like becoming unstuck in time. This coming up summer, I'll have known Gene 44 years. But till I picked her up at the airport last Sunday, I hadn't seen her in more than 41. The last time being Thanksgiving Day, 1973, when the pair of us were like, you know, just two crazy kids with big literary dreams. We both arrived in Ohio in late August 1971, graduate school classmates in the MFA creative writing program at Bowling Green State University. I came from New Jersey. Gene came from Illinois. That I was there at all was completely ridiculous. I still don't know why I was accepted into the program. I had a sociology degree, had written very little prose fiction, maybe half a dozen extremely short stories, all of them goofy and raw and utterly lacking in craft. And I knew little about literature, my reading pretty much consisting of Ramparts and Rolling Stone magazines, the Fantastic Four, Ray Bradbury, Ian Fleming, and Charles Dickens. But Jean, she not only belonged there, she arrived in Ohio with craft coming out of her ears. The vocabulary with which to talk about fiction, I thought point of view was an attitude. And most astounding, and to me most alarming, she knew what and who she wanted to write about. It took me a long time to figure that out. Jean was the only woman in our fiction class. Imagine that. The only woman and the only member of the class who knew what the hell she was doing. The guys, we were all nice enough and fairly serious, but all clueless knuckleheads when it came to the great mysteries of fiction. Either we wrote derivative Hemingway stories, characters tramping around in the woods with shotguns, making rabbit stew and talking obliquely about sex, or else we wrote derivative experimental fiction, with a lot of unnecessary capitalizations and bizarre page formattings. A fiction that meandered and showboated and signified nothing except how green we were. But from the first, Jean wrote stories. Stories with recognizable settings and characters that popped to life on a page. Even in her earliest work, interesting stuff always happened. Actions were motivated and had consequences. Her prose was clean and supple and precise. Man, she was good. I'd get one of her stories for workshop. They were mimeographed, friends. Mimeographed. And if you don't know what that means, look it up. It's in the history books. I'd get one of Jean's new stories, and reading it, I'd want to put a gun to my head and pull the trigger. She was that good. Not only did Jean publish stories before almost everyone else in the class, but she started teaching at the University of Illinois as soon as she left Bowling Green. She was 23 years old, for crying out loud. Best I could get after grad school was editing sleazy magazines. But still, I loved her. And of course, I loved her fiction and read it in magazines and read it in her books. In the Gasoline Wars, from way back, Who Do You Love?, Wide Blue Yonder, City Boy, and in the amazing The Year We Left Home, in the Humanity Project, and most recently, The Witch and other stories, the sly and terrific reimagining of eight classic folk and fairy tales. Jean has been awarded both a Guggenheim and a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship and was a finalist for the National Book Award, which she ought to have won. She ought to have won it several times, in my opinion. In an interview that she gave a few years ago, Jean talked about the nature of her fiction, which has always concerned itself with ordinary people. Everyday life, she said, interests me because it's pretty much the only life we've got, most of us. And I want to believe that within the everyday lurk the ingredients, all the ingredients for tragedy and comedy. I remain hopelessly fascinated by the real and recognizable world. The real and recognizable world. And because of that lifelong focus, she's created a body of work of literature that's rich, honest, truthful, hair-raising, sobering, and quite often hilarious. I may not have seen her for almost 42 years, but I most certainly have followed her career always with unbounded admiration and the most benign jealousy. Ladies and gentlemen, Jean Thompson.
Thank you. agree with Tom's introduction. I can relax a little bit because I was actually really just full of it, you know, as a grad student, and he's been gentlemanly in not telling some of the less flattering stories, you know, but that's okay because he knows I can tell them on him. So it's a mutual disarmament pact or something. Thank you all for coming tonight. I appreciate it. And my thanks to the sponsors of the Visiting Writer Program, to Tom Dodato, who's worked very hard. You know, it takes a lot to get one person here, you know, and to arrange everything. And, of course, to Tom and to Santa for being wonderful hosts. And thank you to my workshop students. I've had a blast with you guys, and they've been very cheerful about accepting way too much good advice, you know, so I appreciate that. The drama of the evening is I'm coming down with a cold, so there may be some special effects here. Sneeze and hack and do all those other great things. And before I forget, you know, the bookstore has been nice enough to, you know, get this very impressive pile of books available. And if anyone wants to have me sign a book they've bought, I'm going to be hanging around here after I finish reading for just that purpose. So let me go ahead and start. What I thought I'd read for you today is a chapter from a novel I've been working on. And it's I'm about 200 pages into it. Doesn't have a title yet. If anybody has any titles when I'm finished, certainly entertain suggestions. It comes early. It's an early chapter, so I don't have to tell you much about it. I don't have to explicate it much. But it's basically a book about two women who are unlikely friends. They're very disparate people and become friends early on in college. So this is a chapter that comes from one of the women's points of view back when they're college students in, I think, 1999. By her senior year of college, Bonnie took to saying that she couldn't wait to get out of the playpen of school and into the real world, even though she did not have any particular destination in the real world. She had begun college as a Spanish major since she'd taken Spanish in high school. She thought that perhaps she could go to Spain or South America to study, end up living an expatriate life that sounded dangerous and glamorous, like Ava Gardner in Night of the Iguana. But her Spanish was not really good enough. Her accent twanged forever Midwestern. In literature classes, she found herself having to read everything in English to keep up, and even then, she didn't much like Don Quixote. Sophomore year, she changed her major to psychology, but that disappointed her also. It was mostly behaviorism and statistics and trying to predict what a rat in a box might or might not do. She had expected to learn about primal drives, the unconscious, dreams, and archetypes, but Freud and Jung were now the grandfathers installed in comfortable chairs in the back room while the party went on without them. The courses Bonnie took were all about experiments and stimulus and response, and although this was left unsaid, the application of these findings to make more people buy more things. She found a home in anthropology, where anything and everything human could be studied. She liked the expansiveness of it, trying to figure people out from every conceivable angle, archaeology and biology and culture and linguistics. She liked the assumption that you actually could figure them out. "You're never going to get a job," Jane said. "There are no jobs called anthropologist. You'll have to go to grad school." Jane was 6 credit hours away from a degree in public health. There was a clear answer to what you did in public health: improve population-based health services and work to eradicate disease. "Syphilis and gonorrhea," Bonnie suggested when she wanted to annoy her. "Pants down for Nurse Jane." But Jane had interviewed with nonprofits and AIDS organizations and public health programs. She would use her critical thinking and writing skills to craft proposals, grants, public education campaigns. Soon, no doubt, she would be getting job offers, deciding between different rollouts of the real job gravy train and functional adulthood. Clever Jane, feckless, unemployable Bonnie, Jane, industrious aunt, Bonnie, fiddling grasshopper, that was her, yep. But she wasn't ready to give in without an argument. "I can do historic preservation, environmental issues, museum work. I'm a generalist." "You could still do something with computers." I'm not one of those business guys. They were class of 1999. The dot-com bubble was still bubbling. I didn't say start a business. I said learn a few things about programming. Add to your skill set. They always need people who know computers. Yeah, and when I was heading off to college, one of my aunts told me I should advertise on the dorm bulletin board to do people's mending and alter hymns, because people always needed that. You're not the mending type, Jane agreed. I don't think I'm the computer type either. Well, you better figure something out if you don't want to have to move back home. Now you're just being mean, Bonnie said. It was the beginning of their final semester, and they were sitting in the living room of their campus apartment. Outside, it was bright and snowless January, the nothing landscape of the Midwest in winter, brown grass, sticks of trees, pavement. Their apartment was on the third floor of a mid-rise building of tan brick. An identical tan brick building was visible across a courtyard. Both buildings and all the other apartment buildings on the block were occupied by students. 20 minutes before classes started, the street doors opened and lines of students hitched to backpacks filled the sidewalks. Bonnie and Jane had lived here more than 2 years, and although they had put a lot of enthusiasm into decorating and arranging the space, by now it was overfamiliar to the point that neither of them really saw it anymore, and with its stacks of books and CDs and plants and candles in the frame, Gauguin prints leaning against the wall so as not to violate the prohibition against putting holes in the walls, it looked a great deal like the apartments of everyone else they knew. Bonnie was bored with saying she was bored and waiting for her jobless future to land on her. If nothing else came through, she was going to move to California, where exactly she did not know, and get a job at a bookstore or a coffee house, or more likely both. The prospect was mildly panic-inducing, but it was a talisman against the used-up feeling of college life. Bonnie's mother and stepfather, who had paid for her education, wanted to believe it had all been worth it, if not in a strict dollars and cents calculation, at least so they would not have to keep worrying about her. Bonnie's stepfather was a sculptor of large, landscape-sized, beaky-looking metalworks, the kind commissioned by enlightened corporations and civic bodies. Bonnie's mother handled the business end of things, keeping the books and wheedling clients. They wanted Bonnie to have some tangible accomplishment, not just be a student of the human condition, which was the unfortunate flip answer she'd given them the last time they'd asked. Bonnie liked to make fun of the stepfather's sculptures. She considered them ugly and overpraised, but they were kind of a big deal, getting respectful mention in art journals and bringing in handsome amounts of money. It was confounding. It put her in a false position to be sniping at something massive, tangible, and successful when she had nothing of her own to set against them. At any rate, she would not be moving back home after graduation, inhabiting a spare bedroom and listening to everybody else's ideas for what she should do with herself. Grad school would be better than that. Of course, she had not applied to grad school, so that wasn't an option either. Jane said, "I don't suppose we could clean the place up some while we're waiting to graduate, you know?" Meaning, it was Bonnie's turn to vacuum and dust and scrub the toilet. It always seemed to be Bonnie's turn, but that was because Jane was so tidy. Jane wore an apron and rubber gloves to do the dishes, scrubbing away like a housewife on speed. She wiped down refrigerator shelves and even cleaned the top of the refrigerator, which Bonnie regarded as something like the free space in Bingo. "Doesn't look so bad. There may not be standards around here, but there are limits." "All right, fine, Mem Sahib, there shall be clean. You know, one reason to get with the program on jobs is so you can hire a maid." "But most elevated Mem Sahib, do you not understand? Maid will be my job." "So funny," Jane said. She stood up from the couch and started straightening a toppling pile of magazines. "Jonah's coming over tonight." Jonah was Jane's boyfriend. They were probably going to get married sometime if she could get Jonah to go along with it. Really not much point in cleaning up ahead of time, is there? Just do it, please. Jane was stomping around the room, or Jane's version of stomping, and looking all furrowed and put out, and Bonnie ventured to ask, "So how is lover boy?" "Oh, he's just great. Rolls out of bed in the morning, watches Sports Center, shows up in class, goes home, plays video games, shows up here, eats whatever I put in front of him, and then we go to bed." "Yeah?" Bonnie prompted her. Jane gave her an irritated look. "Not everything is about sex, you know. my mistake. I really do love him. I just wish he was more... Oh, don't look at me. I don't want to get in trouble. Jonah had a body like a teddy bear and a halo of dark curly hair. He had trouble with his aim when using the toilet. There were any number of things Bonnie might wish he was more of or less of, but it was not always wise to express these. We're really comfortable together. Bonnie waited for it. Maybe too comfortable, Jane added after a beat or two. You mean bored, so all right, what do you want to do about it? I don't know. Jane stopped her pissed-off circuit around the room and stood, swaying a little. She was wearing a pair of unfashionable waist-high jeans. She had a boy's meager butt and hips. She'd cut her hair short, a blonde fringe. It made her look like a Scandinavian athlete who excelled in some minor winter sport. I guess when we graduate, we'll end off going off in different directions anyway. Leave it up to inertia, Bonnie suggested. I thought I wanted to marry him. No, you just thought you wanted to get married. Uh-oh, here it comes. Don't give me that look of loathing. Don't tell me this stuff if you don't want to hear my opinion. Jane sat down on the orange tweed chair they'd bought for a joke, no longer funny. You think I should go ahead and break up with him now? I think we need the wisdom of the elders here, Bonnie said, getting up and going into her bedroom. Oh, God, not the stupid comic books again. Bonnie returned with a handful of tattered and gnawed-looking magazines. Here we go. From the strange turmoil in a woman's heart comes the question, can I forget you? Crap. Jane slid deeper into the orange upholstery. This is from Love Diary, January 1950, Quality Romance Publications, Illustrated. Here's one about a lumberjack. Do we know any lumberjacks? Though I shrank from the look in his eye, in my heart I desired his kisses, and I knew that I was afraid to love. I'm begging you, stop. Dear Diary, I can't understand what's happened to me. I thought I had my emotions under rigid control, that no one could turn me away from the kind of life I chose for myself. But then along came Jack Banton, a big, burly galoot. Do people say that anymore? Galoot? And all my plans were blown sky high. You should see this guy. He looks like a gay pinup. And she's got these pneumatic tits. She's yelling at him, did you hear what I said? Take your hands off me. Then he says, take it easy, sister. I guess they forgot to tell you in that finishing school that up here in the North Woods, women don't give the orders. Now, honestly, doesn't that give you a little retrograde thrill? Oh, sure, domestic violence always does. See, she thinks she's in love with her city slicker boyfriend, but then Jack dives into the river to rescue her from a log jam. What's she doing in a log jam? Unclear. So, he pulls her out of the river and takes her back to his cabin, and would you believe he has a bookshelf full of Shakespeare and Thackeray? He's a self-educated diamond in the rough. The Thackeray is overkill. Agreed. Well, you can guess the rest. She breaks up with the city slicker. His name is Jonah. It is not. Now, what have we learned from this story? We should head for the North Woods and jump in a river. Correct. Okay, here's another. Office Cinderella. Just be patient, Sally. When we're married, I want to support my wife. I don't want to share her with a boss. Yeah, it's hard to find great guys like that nowadays. How about this one? Gee, Ruth, I thought you understood. I'm crazy about you, but, well, a guy doesn't like it when a girl is smarter than he is about everything. Sound of vomiting. This is from Western Love Stories. Can a girl be a sheriff and forget that she is a woman? Lucy performed her duties very efficiently until she had to arrest Dave Ringo, and then she was all woman. Dave Ringo. I bet you money that's not his real name. Jane wriggled herself upright again. Maybe you could get a job as a sheriff. I think I'd like that. These comics have some great ads. The Up and Out bra, with a testimonial by Miss Doris Harris, Wichita, Kansas. Her new attractive bust line has given her poise and confidence. Or perhaps, Jane, your problem is tormenting foot itch? Why do you buy these wretched things? I swear the only thing that's changed in 50 years is reliable contraception. Don't get me wrong, that's not nothing. Why aren't there any romance magazines for men? They're called pornography. Seriously, don't men fall in love? Are they embarrassed about it? What about love poems and love songs? Do they write them just so they can get laid? It's very discouraging. Don't forget to take the garbage out, Jane said, getting up. So, Bonnie resigned herself to cleaning. After Jane left for class, she started in on the bathroom, clearing away all the shampoos and styling products and skin scrubs and toothpaste, the eyelash curlers and lip gloss, all the products with hopeful names meant to evoke, variously, meadows, jungles, deserts, breezes, sultry or fresh, innocence or ripeness. Vanity, vanity, vanity. Would she be any happier with blotchy skin and fuzzy hair? No. It was one more discouraging thing. Bonnie took a sponge and Comet to the shower, and yes, there did seem to be more of her own hair clogging the drain than Jane's, as Jane often noted. She had thick, coiling, dark hair, always falling forward into her eyes. There was too much of it, just as it sometimes seemed there could be too much of Bonnie. You're like a sexual predator, Jane told her once, meaning it mostly but not entirely as an insult. Why, thank you, Bonnie had answered, because what else could you say, really? By now she knew she was different from most women, not even necessarily more juiced up, because how did you measure such things anyway, but willing to go to greater and more outlandish lengths, have the wrong kind of boyfriends and the wrong kind of sex, and go about things all wrong, so that more often than not, her romances ended in wreckage and despair. She wouldn't have said she was in love with every one of them, but often enough she was, and often enough love or keening lust or mad impulse overwhelmed her in ways that confounded and embarrassed her and led her to all manner of bad behavior, including but not limited to drama, indiscretion, urgent phone calls, reckless trysts, peering through windows at night, crying fits on sidewalks, in bars, in a hospital emergency room, outlandish couplings, including in a parked VW Beetle, but that was only the once, and breaking and entering once or possibly twice, even if that particular time she had not meant to go inside, only heave a chunk of rock through a glass door. These were the things that she had told Jane or that Jane had witnessed, although there were some further incidents that Bonnie had not shared. What was wrong with her? She was always too impatient to sit back and wait for boys to come calling, or those who did call didn't please or interest her. She was too full of longing. She wanted what she wanted and saw no reason not to pursue it. And of course, she scared the crap out of most guys, not one of whom was a burly lumberjack who owned a shelf of great books. Laugh all you wanted at the old sappy stories with their cartoon faces and cartoon hairstyles, and all the while sex like a dog under the dinner table, fed in sly handfuls. Hilarious cornball, a triumph of repression aided by industrial strength lingerie. But everybody wanted the dream, the fantasy, the happy ending, and that included her, no matter how much she mocked them. Jane thought that Bonnie was too often unrealistic, that she expected too much. You put so much energy into chasing these guys, you keep trying to turn them into something they aren't. Maybe you should just calm down some. They don't have to be like, make your toes curl every time, do they? How funny it was that they'd met on the occasion of Jane's single most transgressive act, the removal of her virginity by some drunken character she couldn't have picked out of a police lineup, which must have scared Jane away from doing anything so bold ever again, because instead she had a series of boyfriends, each more dreary than the last, the soon-to-be-discarded Jonah the latest. Anyway, it was time to get her head out of her ass, stop thinking about boys and comic books or out of them, and figure out some way to make a living. Bonnie moved on to the kitchen. The stove needed degreasing. The inside of the microwave looked like a miniature crime scene. She hauled the garbage bag out from under the sink and started a new bag, set the morning's oatmeal bowl to soak, swept and mopped the floor. She wasn't enjoying it exactly, but there was an energy to it that carried you along. She would have sung a work song if she'd known any, something about hoeing cotton or hauling in fishing nets. She took the garbage down to the outside bins, not bothering to lock the apartment door behind her, and when she came back and was wrestling the vacuum cleaner out of the hall closet, she looked up to find a man standing in the passageway. Hey! She said, more of a yelp than a word. At first glance, Bonnie took him for a student, but no, he was older, rougher, and shabbier, tall and thin, with his hands jammed into the pockets of his coat. The coat, she noticed, as if this were important, was the same kind as her old high school boyfriend once had, with a facing of soiled fake sheepskin. Hey, "What are you doing? Terry live here?" he asked, looking not at Bonnie but at the floor near his own feet. He had a long, hollowed-out face and droopy blonde hair. "No, you have the wrong apartment." She waited for him to do something, say something. "So you need to get out of here." "Terry back there?" he asked, nodding at the rooms behind her and taking a step towards her. He was between her and the door. Bonnie shoved the vacuum cleaner into the hallway, and that checked him. He took one hand out of his pocket. He held a knife with a short, thick, sharp blade. Bonnie's brain spun like a dial. She could almost hear it making clicking sounds. She was unable to fathom the idea of the knife, of it actually doing something to her. So, out of pure and stupid reflex, she said, "Would you at least get out of the way so I can vacuum?" and bumped the machine towards him. He took a few steps back. "Go on," Bonnie said. "Give me some space here." She stooped down, plugged the vacuum in, turned it on, and advanced on him. It was an old machine, and it made a lot of racket, rooming and humming. Together they rounded the corner, and Bonnie ran the vacuum energetically over the nubby carpet. The man watched her. The hand with the knife hung at his side. Bonnie was aware of some bodily process happening to her from the skin out, a coldness, a quivering, traveling inward in rapid waves until her heart was squeezing through some painful cold. The vacuum went quiet. He had pulled the plug. Bonnie wheeled behind her, retreating into the kitchen portion of the main room, and opened the refrigerator. "Hey, you want a beer?" As long as she kept moving, talking, she felt nothing bad would happen. "Bud Light okay?" She took out two cans of beer and set one on the counter closest to him. "Come on, man, have a drink with me." He looked at the beer can, then down at the knife in his hand, as if asking its opinion. His long, oddball face and long hair made him look as if he'd been stretched out like kid's clay. Bonnie sat down at the kitchen table and opened her own beer. "Make yourself at home," she said, idiotically. He picked up the beer with his free hand and laid the knife down on the counter to open it. The kitchen was small, and he stood maybe 10 feet away from her. Only the dinky table was between them. Bonnie raised her beer and sloshed some into her mouth, swallowed. She watched him drink. Then he set the can down again next to the knife. He wasn't looking at her. He still hadn't looked directly at her. His face had a blank, unseeing quality, or else he was seeing something nobody else did, submerged between layers of murky impulse. "So who's Terry?" Bonnie asked, trying to nudge him towards the surface. "Do I know Terry?" Man or woman, Terry, did it matter? Her heart hurt. It was bruised from all the work of beating, the advice of a million dopey magazines, generations of true romance slipped into a groove in her dumb brain. Show an interest in what he says. Be an active listener. But why was it always the girl who had to make all the effort at conversation? She said, "I'm really thinking you need to check the address again." He took another drink. It made him cough and sputter as if it had gone down the wrong way, and he leaned on the counter trying to recover. "Whoa," Bonnie said. "Easy there." His jaw worked as he tried to set himself to rights. "God damn," he said, still coughing. "Sometimes it helps if you hold your breath," she demonstrated, puffing her cheeks out. "Goddamn sheriff took my dogs away and the county had them put down." "And what did the moron magazines tell you to say to that? Like dating advice or makeup ads were enough to keep you from getting raped and murdered in your own kitchen?" Bonnie felt her face attempting a number of false emotions all at once. Sympathy, interest, indignation on his behalf. "See? Nice person, friend." Not that he was paying any real attention to her. There was something wrong with his mouth, something loose like a baby's. Bonnie started to say she liked dogs, and that's when the man said, "Stupid bitch," spitting the words out like seeds. Who did he mean? Her? Bonnie? The sheriff? Somebody else? Maybe even an actual female dog? And because there was no way of knowing, and what difference would it make anyway, Bonnie said, she shouldn't have done those things she did. "God damn," he said again, and this time it sounded like agreement. He lifted the beer can once more and drank it down. Bonnie got up and fetched another from the refrigerator. She put this one a little farther away on the counter so that he'd have to take a step away from the front door. A part of her mind was working furiously, wondering if she might be able to get to the door or scream, and would anyone hear, and when was Jane due home, and how would that even help since Jane would just stand there pie-eyed, a born victim. But another part of her was curious in spite of or because of everything. Who was he and what made him crazy and dangerous? And had he always been that way? She said, I guess she made you real mad. Hey, what's your name? I'm Bonnie. Are you hungry? How about I fix you a sandwich? Turkey and Swiss, okay? Rattling on. He didn't answer, just opened the new beer and drank from it. He watched as Bonnie moved around the kitchen, yanking bread, plates, the rest that she needed. She made up the sandwich with plenty of everything, mayo, lunch meat, cheese, cut it nicely on the diagonal, and emptied a bag of potato chips into a bowl. Here you go, she said, setting it all down on the table and moving out of the way, just a bit closer to the door. Oh, wait, napkin. Now he was looking at her, which might or might not turn out to be a good thing. He picked up the knife and the beer and sat down in front of the sandwich, stared at it. What'd you put on this? Just mayonnaise. Mayonnaise, all right, I guess, he said, and bent over the plate, using both hands to get as much food as he could into his mouth. Bonnie said, do I know you from someplace? You go to the bars or anything? He didn't answer, still working on the sandwich. You saw guys like him on campus often enough, panhandlers or criminals or both, homeless or close to it, hanging around because students were stupid and careless and easy pickings. Well, she sure was. Why hadn't she locked the damn door behind her and taken her keys? She tried again. You from around here? He was eating the chips now, crunching them by the handful. She was running out of things to feed him, inane questions to ask him. She ducked around the table, keeping it between them, and ran water in the sink. Mind if I clean up some? He didn't answer. He was sucking bits of food from the inside of his mouth. Bonnie opened the cupboard under the sink and put on Jane's big green rubber gloves. It was comforting putting this extra protective layer over her skin. Yeah, it's my turn to, you know, shovel the place out. He wasn't paying her any particular attention. Why should he? She was just some random body currently making noise. Beneath the sink were the usual scrubbers and sponges and soaps, when what she really needed was a baseball bat, the sort of things they made weapons out of on television, batteries and matchsticks and chewing gum. All she could find was a spray bottle of some vile mildew remover Jane had bought for the bathroom. It had a reassuring trigger grip, and she set it out on the counter with one green-gloved hand. Not that most of the mess isn't mine, not all of it, most. The man shifted around in his chair and the plates on the table jumped. You sure run your mouth a lot. I do, nervous habit. Was he angry? She guessed she should shut up now, but she couldn't stop, because they might be the last words she ever said, aside from those things he might soon make her say. I really think men and women speak different languages. I bet if you did a scientific study, you could prove it, because men aren't socialized to talk about emotions, relationships. I get that. But see, women can't leave that stuff alone. We want men to pay attention to us, the right kind of attention, not the breaking and entering and assault kind. I mean, Bonnie's breath ran out. She stopped her babbling to pry her lungs open. Did you and her have some kind of fight? You know, what happened? Her and her big deal friends. Ah, Bonnie said, nodding. They was always against me. Right, because what could any fair-minded person object to? They ganged up on you, Bonnie suggested. The law took her side, too, like a man doesn't have a right to live under his own roof. His hand on the table was a fist now. Behind her back, Bonnie made a green rubber fist with one hand. She said, but there must have been things you liked about her. It wasn't all bad, was it? He didn't answer right away, but gave her another glance that had some seeing in it. Like, what was Bonnie doing here in the middle of his righteous grievances? Bonnie said, I mean, maybe the two of you could make up, unless he had already murdered her. A fresh start, sort of like cleaning house. She picked up the bottle of cleanser and waved it around. Everybody cops to their share of the dirt, you know? He said, how is it a woman always thinks she can talk her way out of anything? She was quiet then. He tipped the can up to empty it. A little of the beer dribbled past the loose corner of his mouth. He wiped at it with the back of his hand and pushed his chair away and patted at the pockets of his coat. Looking for something? Not the horrible knife. It was right there in front of him on the table. Cigarettes? Her high school boyfriend, the one who'd had the same kind of coat, had smoked, and they used to argue about it because Bonnie said the smell got into her hair and clothes. They'd gone round and round about it. Of course, the cigarettes were just an excuse to argue about everything they couldn't put into words, how their bodies bewildered them, now impossibly close, now separating into two contrary creatures, so that there was always longing and always the confusion of feeling. They had been so young. His name was Eddie. Where was he now? She didn't know. He'd moved away and she'd lost track. She would have liked to find him again and tell him what she had learned in all this time. She burst into sudden, noisy tears. "Now quit that," the man said, annoyed. "It's not needed." "It doesn't have anything to do with you." Bonnie reached for a paper towel and blew her nose. "Oh, ha. I don't care if you believe me or not. I was thinking about my very first boyfriend. Well, not the very first, but the first important one, and how we really did love each other, but we were too young and, I guess, angry to know it." "What a woman means by love is, give me all your money," he pronounced, sneering. "That is so unfair, and I'm sorry I don't believe you. You wouldn't be so criminally vicious, upset if you and whoever she is hadn't started out with some kind of love." The crying had clogged up her nose. She reached for another paper towel and honked into it. "She sure didn't seem to mind driving my car, emptying out my wallet." At least he was having an actual conversation, not just muttering grievances. "Well, I never took anybody's money. I never went out with anybody for their money." Sneering again. "Then somebody got himself a good deal." "Wait, I get it. You think women trade sex for money? That is totally, totally insulting." "Yeah," he said, but it was as if he was losing patience with talk. Maybe she should not have said sex. "So you're mad because things didn't work out and because it cost you money?" "None of your business." "We're just trying to figure things out," Bonnie said, and then there was a silence. She would scream if she had to, scream and scream. He rubbed at his eyes, yawned. Maybe he was just sleepy or on some crazy making drugs. She should have thought of the drugs right away. She watched his head nod lower, hoping he'd just nod off. But he jerked himself awake and said, "I allow that a mother loves her child, but that's the whole of it. You are so, so wrong. It's all about what a woman wants to get off a man and what a man wants to get off a woman," he said, looking Bonnie over in a nasty way, which she pretended not to notice. "All right, so there's no such thing as unselfish love. There's just greed and lust and narcissism." "What the hell's that mean?" "Narcissism, that's basically when you're in love with yourself. You learn that in college, huh?" Ignoring him, Bonnie said, "According to you, everybody who thinks they're in love is either a liar or a fool. That's nice. That's real healthy. You can shut up any time now." "No, see, I get it with all you guys. Love is unmanly because it involves loss of control. Sure, think of all the crazy things you do when you're in love. You, like, humiliate yourself and talk baby talk. And, well, I'm not even going to tell you some of the things I've done. It's so much easier to say it's all about sex because that involves these fantasies of conquest and domination." He actually put his hands over his ears then. Bonnie went on, half inspired, half just making noise. "And I guess that's why you go looking for women you can victimize, because there's not any emotional component, the part that's so difficult if it's a true peer relationship. I don't suppose you have any gay male friends." "Who are you calling gay?" he said, the blurry look coming into his eyes again. And right then the door to the apartment opened and Jane and Jonah came in. "Hey," Jane began, and then the two of them stopped short, taking things in. They had been to the caramel corn shop, and they were both holding bags of popcorn as if they had just walked into a movie. Bonnie grabbed the mildew remover, aimed, and pulled the trigger. The bottle sputtered. A little foam dribbled out and over a rubber glove, and they all stared at that. The man cleared his throat. "Okay if I use your bathroom?" "Sure," Bonnie said. "That-a-way." He got up and squeezed past Jane and Jonah, who shuffled together to give him room. He left the knife on the kitchen table. The bathroom door shut behind him. "Really?" Jane said. "I mean, he's kind of on the scabby side. Where did you meet him?" Bonnie hissed at her to shut up. The toilet flushed. "Open the front door. Stay out of his way." The man came back into the room, looked around at the three of them as if he'd asked a question and was waiting for the answer. "Bye," Bonnie said melodiously. "Take it easy." He took his time leaving. When he was gone, Bonnie said, "Shut the door, lock it." Jane looked out into the hallway, then closed the door and turned the latch. No offense, but I kind of hope you broke up with him. Jenna wandered over to the kitchen table, munching popcorn. His cheeks bulged as he chewed. Bonnie supposed she ought to be grateful to him, since only a male presence had scared her visitor away. But he was so perfectly and willfully dull, such a well-kept animal. Was it wrong to expect so much more? He picked up the knife. "Hey, what's this?" he said through crumbs. Bonnie said, "Would one of you knuckleheads call the police? Never mind, I'll do it myself." This was how she came to work in the field of crisis intervention. The end. Thank you.